Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
With the Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
All right, welcome back. We're going to be talking to an author who has, as I point out, he's an Emmy Award winner and many other types of awards like Tellys and things like that. But he's also a writer. He's got a new novel out. It's called Revolution Empire. I read you one of the reviews from Homeschool Curriculum Training and Support Group. HomeLink Yakima said it offers the brutal truth of absolute power and the preciousness of the freedom that can defeat it. Another review said, serious though its themes are, Revolution Empire is above all entertaining, highly readable. It will find a big audience, and so its ideas will be deservedly spread wide. Stories like Revolution Empire give us hope that the young will leave behind a better world than that which previous generations have handed them. And then finally this, to pull the reader deep into a web of dystopian oppression and thrilling intrigue, Rob has created a strange new world that will be eerily familiar to careful readers and students of history, and I would say probably to careful observers of what is happening to us right now. So joining us now is Rob Travellino. Thank you for joining us, Rob.
Pleasure to be here, David. Thanks for having me.
Let's talk a little bit about what inspired this. And I'm sure there's a lot of parallels to contemporary events and dystopian novels. What inspired you to write this?
Oh, man, it's been a long journey. Part of it really just comes out of my career. I started off at a college in advertising and marketing. I had intended to be a journalist. During my senior thesis, I got to interview some people high up in a major network news organization. This is back in the late 80s, who actually told me, because I was trying to determine whether news was still news or whether it had become more entertainment-based. Mm-hmm. And they told me on the network side that I should go into like local newspapers or something else, because the network news had sort of been hijacked a little bit by corporate sponsors, telling them what they wanted them to say and sort of approving copy and approving stories. And, you know, the Russell Crowe movie, The Insider, certainly talked a lot about that, showing the trouble they had exposing big tobacco. Mm-hmm. Because the network was trying to censor the story, or the sponsor was trying to censor the story.
Yeah.
And oddly enough, I was drafted into advertising. Basically, I interned at an ad agency in college, and they hired me on the spot. And so I went on this really strange journey in advertising for a number of years. I worked a lot in the kids space. I worked on G.I. Joe, or I worked on Transformers, I worked on Batman, I worked on bringing all of these really big franchises to market. And while I was there, and this is kind of a convoluted journey, but I'll tie it all together, I started to see from inside the sort of the boardrooms of the kids business, as the corporate concerns in the 90s and in the mid 90s started buying more and more of kids companies, that there was an agenda driving the narrative in the country in terms of how entertainment was being sort of steered toward something. And I didn't know what it was, but it wasn't, it at some point, it wasn't as much about kids and their power and their empowerment. It was more about somebody else's sort of molding into the message they wanted, if that makes sense.
Oh, yeah.
And so rather than selling toys and games to kids and teenagers, I wanted to sell them what kids and teenagers play with toys and games for. They play because they want to learn about good and evil. They want to learn about changing the world. They want to learn about their personal power and not the brand they're being sold. The brand they want to develop is themselves, their own sort of, you know, determination, their own ability to sort of make their own life. And so that sort of molded into my entertainment career. And the where Revolution Empire came to be was after selling a TV show to Disney and developing a TV show for Discovery, I sort of got the gist in the sort of in the entertainment space that, again, there was an opportunity to give kids stories that were self-determinist, that were sort of about core rights and core principles and about the things that kids can do outside the system and within the system to change the system, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Right.
And then as I watched the world sort of change over the last, you know, 10, 15 years, especially, I saw the, you know, changes, the Patriot Act, things coming up. I saw rights being sort of stripped away. I saw things in, you know, in the culture and in the entertainment space and in the political space, all starting to work in a similar fashion or a similar agenda. Mm-hmm. And not to put it towards a conspiracy angle, but the profit motive, I think, kicked the door open for big companies and governments to recognize that the more you could control discourse and narrative, the more money you could make. If that makes sense.
Oh yeah, I just played a clip earlier in the show about Larry Fink saying that 6 years ago. He said we're going to force corporations to do this and that because you got the purse strings and you've got unlimited amount of money if you do what we say. Otherwise, you're not going to get anything. And even so, that really becomes what they're focused on. They're focused on satisfying the people at the top of the economic food chain. Who are above the corporate level, and they're focused on selling a narrative that the government likes as well. So that's really a prescription for disaster, a prescription for a kind of dystopian society that you talk about in your novel, and you have a lot of parallels into the American Revolution. Talk a little bit about that. Well, it's set in kind of is it a parallel universe, or is it a kind of a recapitulation of the American Revolution that you see in this empire?
I kind of look at it like a thought experiment, and the idea being that I don't define whether it's a parallel universe or if it's a future time. I kind of leave that open for the reader. Mm-hmm. But ultimately, as I looked at the world changing, and this is interesting you brought up, Larry, but the idea that if you look at the way the world is sort of headed, you see a large sort of globalism component to it. You see a lot of a recipe for tyranny. You see a lot of recipe with surveillance, with, you know, you having to register all of your devices a certain way. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying that we've hit tyranny yet, but there's an incredible danger and potential for it. And when you look back at the revolution, of the United States in 1776, it was the largest corporate entity on the planet was the East India Trade Company. And the British Empire was the largest corporate banking entity on the planet. Mm-hmm. And so it's almost like history is repeating in a way. I know I see you smiling because that's what the danger is to me. And so when I looked at that and I look at the way from the inside the advertising marketing space, how, people were segmented and divided. When I hear people talking about systemic racism, And I hear people complaining about it in the context of the present day, I watched corporate America for years segment minorities, blacks here, Hispanics here, whites here, Asians here, and everything else. And they sold to them that way. Mm-hmm. They sold to them that way because it made more money. Whether they did it on purpose or whether they did it by accident, the quest for profit created a systemic inequality. And those things are all tyrannical in their own sort of sense when they're taken far enough. If that makes, correct?
Oh, yeah.
A little too off the rails, but the as I looked at things, I looked at a present day version of royalty and elitism in celebrity culture, in expert culture. You can't make a decision without an expert telling you what to do. You can't make a decision without government telling you what's best for you. Mm-hmm. You can't make a decision without, your computer reminding you that you shouldn't do this, or your software telling you, hey, step back and you can't say this, or you shouldn't be mindful of your words. I use a program called Grammarly, which constantly tells me, beware of the, you know, worry about your speech and you're being not being inclusive here and you're doing this. I'm like,
so they folded in the Associated Press's the terms that you're allowed to use for this and that. They've
kind
folded
of,
that into Grammarly now.
Permeating it through everything. And you know, and you look at the core and I look at the, to go off on another small little tangent, there's a effort in the last 20 years to make socialism seem like it's a wonderful thing.
Mm-hmm.
And historically, and again, this is leaving the ideologies out of it and the current political discourse out of it. Historically, socialism and communism have killed more people than most wars combined.
That's right.
And so why are we talking about that? Why are we suddenly making it look like it's okay? And then when you look at that in the context of, you know, how control systems work and how, you know, altering language, for example, cancel culture and altering language is a version of Marx. That's a Marxism playbook. It's right out of the playbook of socialism and Marxism.
That's right.
Hijack a word, make it not okay, create another word and make that word okay, and then make everyone go in line. And at some point, you're actually giving away your right to speak by association.
Mm-hmm.
And so and that's a very slippery slope between losing your right to speak freely out of association to losing your right to speak by mandate, by law, by some official decree. And when you look back in the revolutionary days, people were jailed for pamphlets that they said. They were unjustly accused and taken prisoner during the American Revolution during the early stage of the American Revolution for speaking out against the king and speaking out against the, you know, taxes and speaking out against the infringements on their rights. And so I look at the world today and I go, I hope we're not heading that way, but a lot of signs point to the fact that we're heading that way. Now,
well, you know, human nature doesn't change. That's one of the reasons why, as you pointed out, you know, the corporations change and the nature of the business changes. You know, we don't have the East India Company anymore. But we've got Big Pharma, we've got other things that are out there, and they're going to be allied with the government that is there, and kind of, a lot of these ideological labels are there kind of as a distraction, I think, to keep us from really seeing what's happening here, because there's a merger between the government and between these corporations, and we even have this, you know, we have some people over there who say, well, you know, the corporations can do no wrong, the government can do no right, and vice versa. They don't understand how they have merged together. And so that's a key thing. And so in your book, human nature does not change, but it's interesting to be able to reach a younger audience,
right,
to show them and to put it in a different context, because you start telling them some of these things and going back in history, and it's like, oh, I can't relate to that. They didn't have phones and they didn't have cars or whatever, virtual reality. So I can't really relate to that world. So you put in some of the trappings that we have now, because human nature doesn't change, and you still have essentially the same story is going to be repeated again, right?
And that's the fascinating thing. That was always a fascinating thing for me, because the idea that when I looked back at the, if you Google, you know, some of the founding fathers' words and the documents and the Federalist Papers and everything else, you tend to get, you know, 20 search results that are irrelevant or are why they don't apply, why they don't work in today's world,
yeah,
or they're bastardized and changed and almost manipulated versions of what they are, or they're spun to an agenda. And again, I'm not saying that is, there's some concerted effort going on, because I don't know and I can't prove that, but it certainly seems like there's an effort to disempower the founding principles of this nation. Whereas, yes, but in the meantime, they were the truths that were unassailable in the 1700s and in the 1800s. Those truths could not be, at some level, could not be argued with. You could not argue with you're born with inherent rights. You cannot argue with, you know, some of the core principles of the ownership of private property are what actually are tied inextricably to freedom, because if you can't own things, you have no freedom.
That's right.
At some point.
And they don't want us to have any freedom or dignity. That's one of the things you look at, especially the last few years. It's like a B.F. Skinner type of world that they've created. And he said, you know, we need to move beyond freedom and dignity. And they want to move, in order to move beyond freedom and dignity, they want to move beyond these principles that were put there because people had lived under tyranny and they knew what it looked like. Yeah, they're pretty obvious about the fact when you listen to these people in academia, they're upfront about the fact that they want to deconstruct everything about our society and our culture and government and everything else and institute, you know, what we have seen in the past is pure dystopian societies, and we can.
And doesn't history isn't history full of, you know, examples every few decades, every 100 years, every millennium, where that does not work, and eventually human beings who have an inherent sort of drive to believe in greater things, an inherent drive to be free to choose, ultimately end up saying, we can't do this. It's against my nature. Mm-hmm. You know, human nature has, again, it's a double-edged sword. You know, if we look at, you know, in the John Milton Faustian sense, it's a double-edged sword because you're either going to sell yourself for some security in the Ben Franklin sense, you know, you're going to give up some for security and liberty in the, you know, the interest of security, and then you're going to lose these things forever. And at some point you're going to like, I want them back because that's who defines who I am. Mm-hmm. And so, revolution, again, you can't teach that necessarily to a kid. And in a young adult novel space, you can't just go out and say, here's the article, here's the Bill of Rights, here's this, and you could teach them in a classroom, here's why these things matter, here's why these things worked, here's why these things took down tyranny globally for a period of time. Mm-hmm. They took down authoritarianism globally. They took down communism, you know, in every instance until...
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Maybe recently.
Yeah.
And so, you know, ultimately the best way to teach those things, or at least give people the choice again, because that's, for me, that's the birth of Revolution Empire came out of what I saw was we're losing the choice. Yes. We're losing the free will we're supposed to be born with, and we're losing the free will that the country had instilled and enshrined in its very founding documents and core principles. And so these things, you know, you can take these things in small doses, and I'll get to the book in a second. Mm-hmm. And you can say, you know, you can look at the 1619 projects and go, okay, here's all the bad things we did. But you can also look at the fact that all those documents and all those core principles are how we ended the bad things that human nature allowed us to do.
Like talk a little bit. You mentioned Franklin. You know, of course, Franklin talking about people who are willing to trade essential liberty for the promise of safety, because he knew that wasn't going to be safe, and that you enslave yourself to the extent you enslave yourself, you're not safe, you're not prosperous, none of this, and of course they never deliver on that. But how does that? I'm sure that plays a part in your book. Talk a little bit about that, the trade-off between liberty and safety.
I looked at the world around me, and I saw that we were moving sort of in that direction. We were moving in the direction, as Ben Franklin say, and again, it's an illusion of security in a lot of ways, right? Mm-hmm. Because all the things we're being sold now, we're not any more secure. We're actually less secure. So I looked at the world. I noticed that there was an incredible parallel between the way things were headed and the royal kings and queens, you know, giant financial concerns that everything about them was being in control, dictating what my subjects could do, defining their freedoms, and then holding the purse strings so that if they were bad citizens or they didn't do what we wanted to, we would just take away their very ability to survive. We'd take away their livelihoods, we'd take away their money. Yeah. And if we had to, we'll constantly increase, you know, their expenditures in the form of different taxes in different ways. And so when I looked at that, I was like, well, this is something that I think we all really feel, because as adults and as taxpayers, we always know that it's always a battle of each little slice, whether it's coming in inflationary, inflation's sort of a hidden tax. There's a fee for this, it's a tax. And now corporations are on board. They're charging a fee for everything. You used to have all these things on a navigation system in a car that now you have to pay extra for. Mm-hmm. You're constantly being reduced in your choices unless you pay for them or unless you play nice to get them. And that's very similar to the British Empire in a lot of ways, and what happened with the colonies, and an age-old struggle between, you know, the population of the people with the rights they feel they have. So I wanted to construct a world that would allow kids and teenagers and young adults to learn the concepts as they read them and as they saw them, as opposed to reading them off of these old documents that to me are relevant, to you are relevant, but to a 17-year-old or 16-year-old, maybe not so much. But the concepts under them are timeless. The concepts under them still apply. The concepts under them, when you really study them and actually learn them and realize what they say, and don't read the Cliff Notes version or the version somebody told you to read, you say, "Wait a second! This is what my struggle is. This is childhood. This is adolescence. This is young adulthood. This is all the stuff I'm doing. I'm trying to define who I am. I'm trying to find my power. I'm trying to find my right to be who I am." And instead of having it being sold to us, well, you can be this, or you can be that, or you can be this. No, you're not supposed to be sold a menu of things you can be. You're supposed to decide what you want to be. If you have to create something new to be, that's what you should be able to do. Or create a new, you're supposed to be able to create a new world starting with yourself. And so Revolution Empire basically is a dystopian thought experiment on what would a surveillance state, technologically advanced society look like blended with the world of the 1700s.
That's great.
And so I use some of the slang of the period. So there's colonial slang throughout the book.
Oh, that's interesting.
I used
for example, what kind of colonial slang?
Colonial slang are things like you would call the boxman. You'd instead of calling an undertaker, you would call him the boxman. And an undertaker at the time was an undertaker slash pawnbroker, because he would take. I mean, you see like the old Christmas Carol scene. Where the undertaker is selling off property from the person who died because they had no relatives, or they had nobody to bequeath to. And so that's what undertakers were. They were boxmen. They would just box up you and your stuff, and then they would bury some and sell the rest.
That's great. They accuse people of being a nutmeg addict.
Yeah, exactly. So fire cake is a hard baked, like hard tack, that just kind of, it's just, whatever dough you got, thrown together and baked into like a hard biscuit that can be stored and held for long periods of time. And because the kids in the story, Revolution Empire also, the entire story are teenagers. Everybody's teenagers in their 20s that are the critical aspect of the story, because people don't realize or recognize so much that there were people who signed the Declaration of Independence that were 22 years old, 24 years old. That's there right. were people fighting in the war that were 14 and 15 years old. There were people who were founding players to be, that chose to do this at 14, 15, 16, 17, and left home. Some people disguised themselves as adults. Some women disguised themselves as men to join the fight. It's a remarkable story that we don't have told in the detail that it really happened. So I'm faithful to a lot of the things that really took place.
And that's an important thing as well, because we are so babied in our society. We live in this for 12 years. You go to this institution where everything is highly structured. You got one authority figure up in the front of the room and that type of thing. But in the real world of a couple of hundred years ago, just, or even less than that, people would grow up very, very quickly. They would be given command in some cases of ships as teenagers. And, it was done on the basis of merit, but they would mature very, very quickly. They'd stay in a babysitting environment for that long. And I think that's one of the reasons why it seems like the longer you stay in school, the dumber you get, because it's like a babysitting. Okay. It dulls your imagination. It actually dulls your inquisitiveness and critical thinking and all the rest of this stuff by just kind of keeping you in this controlled environment. But that's a real important thing for people to learn. And I think that is something that is very beneficial for young kids to see. I know my son learned to read by reading G.A. Hinty novels. He was a novelist back in the Victorian period. And he would take a 17-year-old and he would put that 17-year-old in a historical context. And he would be interacting with these historical adult figures that you know of, right? But he would be right there in the midst of it. There's always a coming-of-age novel. I imagine that's a key part. You talk about the characters being 17 years old and around that age.
Donovan Rush is the main protagonist of the story, and he's kind of a blend of George Washington, Thomas Paine, and Benjamin Rush.
Well, that sounds great.
basically the premise of Revolution Empire is there's an underground society that is literally under the empire. The empire is kind of like a giant city state, and it's miles high. And literally buried under it is the remnants of a previous world, of a previous civilization. Hmm. In that civilization lives kind of the disenfranchised. And since I've had to set it up in a present context, it's kind of like the disenfranchised masses. It's anybody who's at or below the poverty line, or at or below the cultural line in the world today, whether they're refugees, whether they're, you know, Native Americans, whether they're, you know, inner city kids, black, white, Hispanic, because, you know, I did a documentary in the South in the late 2000s, and I found unbelievably depressed and poor cities in the South that were incredibly integrated because they all had everything in common. Mm-hmm. They were all struggling together to survive. And when you look at the world from that perspective, you realize, especially now that we're so top heavy with a small group of people controlling, well, I forgot what it is, it's 90 something percent of the wealth is controlled by like 5% of the people in the world. And so in a lot of ways, we are all in some form of debt servitude, and we are all in sort of the same boat in a lot of ways. And there's something very similar in that regard to people who leave home to go to a new world for the hope of finding a way to build a better life because they were sort of the cast offs of society, or they were disenfranchised, or they lacked the freedom to be who they wanted to be, whether it was religious freedom, whether it was economic freedom, whatever it might be. Mm-hmm. So the world is literally underground, called the sewers. These people live in near perpetual darkness, and all they have left behind is a book written by a guy named Dr. Princeton Rush, who's kind of like a Thomas Paine, Benjamin Rush character. And he's the father of Donovan Rush. And he wrote this long treatise on rights and on inherent rights and on property ownership and on liberty and all these concepts that these kids have no idea of because they live in this oppressed under society where they're not allowed anything. They're basically allowed what gets thrown down from Empire City into their midst. Except for Empire City has a form of a lottery, which is, again, vaguely familiar to today's world. These magnetically floating ships will come down once in a while, find groups of kids that shouldn't be assembled or find kids to pick, and they'll literally lift them up into the light, and it's called becoming an empire builder. You're brought out into the light of Empire City and offered a chance to serve his magistrate in a much more sort of, you know, advanced way. You get coveralls on, you get dressed in the empire garb, and you get a chance. It's like winning a lottery ticket, so that you're suddenly being granted the opportunity to get out of your miserable state and into a land of opportunity where you can, quote unquote, be whatever you want to be. But it's only if you succumb to all the rules that are in the empire system that's above you. And very few kids get up here and get accepted and get kept. So Donovan, in his following his father's book, looks for a way out of the sewers for his people, for his kind, for all the people that are sort of aligned with him, all the kids, all the people who are disenfranchised. And he gets taken in an empire builder transport and dumped into the city and brought to the magistrate's tower and meets a guy named Dr. Richard Franklin, who's a sort of rakish character in the empire who is a friend of his father's. Hmm. And got his father a pardon from a death sentence and thrown in jail. And Donovan is finding his way to the empire. And Franklin was hoping, because he's sort of a Ben Franklin character, that some kid would break out at some point and lead a change, because Franklin thinks the empire is unjust. And so he's working sort of clandestinely to undermine it. So when this kid appears in the Empire City, he sees the next level of prison. So his father always says that, like, freedom, they can't, if the one place they can't take freedom from is in here. That's where the one prison you can put yourself in is in your own head. Yes. And once you're in that prison, you're never going to get out. So once you realize that you're free there, you can free yourself everywhere else. So once the kid goes back to the sewers, he organizes a channel crossing, which is kind of like Washington crossing the Delaware, where these kids break out of the sewers and they sail across this massive channel and they land on the shores of the colonies. The colonies are a industrial business sort of suburb of Empire City, where the people there aren't allowed to go to Empire City either. They're the commercial engine, factory workers, all the people who do all the working to support the empire. So they are separated like the American colonies, but they can't go back and forth. Mm-hmm. Some of the people in power can go back and forth, but most people work there their whole lives, and some of their money goes to the empire. So when Donovan realizes that the world is unjust, based on his father's writings, he leads a landing in the colonies. And that's the first book, because the empire realizes they've got a problem and they don't know who caused it. And they suspect that Richard Franklin is behind it. And they realize the only way they can quell it is by giving some of these sewer rats a foothold in the colonies, as long as it makes money for them, mm-hmm. as long as it helps them stay in control. And so it's out of one trap into another trap, waiting to get into another trap. And so that's kind of how the book is set up.
Interesting. Kind of like some of the people who came to America as indentured servants. It was being run by this. Interesting.
And they actually employ them as indentured servants once they land in the colonies.
Yeah, interesting. Show the cover of the book there. Again, the first book is Revolution Empire. And there are several books in the series, right? How many of them?
There's three. The first one is called Revolution Empire, History Never Retreats. Mm-hmm. And that tells the story of Donovan Rush escape from the sewer and leading some of the sewer rats, as they're called, to the colonies. And then there'll be a second book, which is already written, called The Wild Colonials, which shows.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
What happens there? And another thing that's really important to the book is that all of the main characters keep journals. And so the book does a very unique thing where there's journal pages spaced throughout it. So every once in a while, you get an internal dialogue from Donovan, an internal dialogue from Richard Franklin, an internal dialogue from various other characters. And all the words and all the dialogue are based upon the writings, speeches, and letters of Ben Franklin, Thomas Jefferson, John Adams, because all the characters are in the story. So you learn, as a reader, the concepts that again, to circle it back again, I know I talked about a lot of things because I tend to globally go all over the place, but you learn the concepts of the Federalist Papers, you learn the concepts of, you know, the motivations behind George Washington and John Adams. You see what made them tick, and you hear their own words through the journal entries, but you don't absorb it as the dense information as it is. You learn it on the fly as it applies to the situations that these characters are in. And you look at a world that's reflective of today and you go, oh crap, that matters. This matters, and this matters. This is why it matters. This is why people break out of a prison to try to, instead of just to be free, but to change the world. This is why, you know, this is why people take the stands they take. This is why people recognize inequality in its true forms. This is why people recognize tyranny. It's why people can recognize authoritarianism, because, you know, there's standards, but there's standards of individual power and individual rights that without them, you can't measure authoritarianism and tyranny. You can't expose it and recognize it until you realize what it actually takes from you personally.
Oh, that's a great way to put it. And that's a really ingenious idea that you've got there. I mean, you're giving them the philosophies and the writings in a way that, you know, is being put out there gradually and in a context that they can relate to. And they're not realizing that they're really learning this kind of stuff. You know, that's one of the difficult things about educating kids, because or anybody, you know, it's you put stuff out in a didactic way, like a lecture, and you say, well, this is this, right, and that is that. And that doesn't really get through to most people. You know, it's like handing them, you know, some kind of a pamphlet or something like that. But then the next step is to do a documentary. And the documentary is more engaging because you see visceral pictures and you hear people and you see things. And so that brings it in a little bit more. But when you do it as a work of fiction, you can really draw them in a very visceral way, because they can get inside the characters' heads. And that's a really ingenious way to educate these kids about these principles that are so vital and so timeless that are now being destroyed. And that's a great approach. I really love what you're doing with that.
I appreciate that. That's my worry. My worry is some of these things have been lost. Some of these things are being taken away. Some of these things are under attack. And the way the narrative discourse is going, you know, in terms of the medium, you know, obviously yourself and those who are, you know, talking about the same subjects as you and examining the world the same way you are, your voice is getting, people try to distract people from what you're talking about. People try to distract people away from, there's an agenda trying to silence the discourse.
Yeah.
One of the things that, you know, Elon Musk talks about in Twitter, in terms of the restoration of free speech, whether he's done it or not, or whether, you know, what his ultimate intentions are, although I'm fascinated by what he's been doing, mm-hmm. You know, without the discourse, without the free speech, without the ability to discuss these things, and really look at them, you know, freely and fully, we're going to lose them.
Yeah.
And we're already losing them to some extent. So the book is really designed, you know, not to push a certain agenda, but just to make the comparison between, I mean, obviously every writer has an agenda to some extent, but my agenda is to expose again where the dangers are in the present world, where those dangers are historically, where they've always sat, where they've always been, the damage they have caused, but what they fundamentally take away from us as individuals, mm-hmm. the rights they really strip, the control they really exert, all the flavors of the control and all the flavors of servitude they put upon you, so that people, kids will learn through the course of an adventure, they'll say, wow, I agree with this thing that Donovan's fighting about. I agree with this thing that John A. is talking about. That's the John Adams character. Mm-hmm. I agree with this thing that Richard Franklin is talking about. I see what they're fighting against. It's actually kind of like what I see going on around me. And then at least have the conversation and say, well, if this applies in this narrative concept, in this entertainment concept that I'm looking at, but it's reflective of the world, like all good entertainment is always, I got to think about this. Because if I'm being told this all the time, but this feels true, we got a problem. We should be talking about this. And that's what I'm hoping. I'm hoping the book is a conversation piece.
Oh, yeah. And of course, it's key. You know, we go back and we look at the middle of the 20th century, Orwell, Solzhenitsyn. They understood that it was about control over your mind, right? 2 + 2 = 5, or language, and getting you to say even what you know is not true. So Solzhenitsyn wrote, you know, live not by lies, because he knew that was the ultimate thing to get you to live by what you knew was not true. That's how they control your mind. That's what totalitarianism is. But of course, Jefferson understood that as well. That's not a new insight. You know, one of his most famous quotes, it's inscribed there at the monument to him in Washington, is, fighting every form of tyranny over the mind of man. And so he knew that tyranny's ultimate throne was to take control of your mind. And yep. These people, you look at it, one of the things I find interesting about the American Revolution is that these people were very wealthy and elitist, and yet they didn't accrue all that power to themselves because right. they also saw themselves as the underdog to an even higher tyranny that was there. What you talked right. about, the East India Company and the big bank and the big corporations and the big empire and all the rest of this stuff. And they didn't want to recreate that because they knew what it was like to live under that. In the same way that people who've lived under a communist government can smell that a mile away. These right. people knew what totalitarianism was about. They knew it was a tyranny over the mind of man and all the rest. That's why they enshrined freedom of speech and religion as the very first thing. But they understood that. And so they weren't going to reinvent that. And we're coming up to a time where things are getting very difficult. And if the population doesn't have this understanding of what tyranny looks like, and the reason right. that we had these things in there, we're in big trouble. That's why what you're doing in terms of reaching to kids that way and you know, putting it in this context where they can understand, assimilate, and identify with it, that's really important. So I can understand why the Homeschooling Foundations would recommend your book. So there's going to be three of them, right? The first one's about to come out in July.
Yeah, and the three of them, and the third one goes up to a surprise ending, but I obviously can't tell you about it. But the idea is that there's way more than three books to tell the story fully, because it's the story parallels the American Revolution. So it parallels an uprising in the colonies, you know, a stand against the empire at some point, and all the players are involved. And you know, I don't know how into the details of history you are, but even characters on the other side are you know, represented. You know, General Burgoyne is in the story. There's a guy named Banastre Tarleton, who is a notoriously vicious British officer.
Oh,
who war crimes. He's a central character to the story. And I've added other characters into the story. There's a gang leader named KZ, who is loosely based on the Marquis de Lafayette, but a combination of the Marquis de Lafayette and sort of Confucianism, and because there's a component of the empires outside of the empire itself. There are other geopolitical players that are reminiscent and reflective of today's world, because I need a France and I need a Spain and a Portugal in the story. But if you look at today's world, we have all that stuff still going on, because we used to have all the great seafaring, you know, nations. Now the nations that have, you know, giant, you know, navies and nuclear arsenals. So they're the same. It's the same struggle, right? It's always the same struggle.
Yeah.
It's a struggle for resources. It's a struggle for hearts and minds. It's a struggle for, you know, for influence. And so all these things are incredibly reflective. If you look at the American Revolution in the context of, I want to find everything that's wrong with it, you can. If you want to look at, you know, if you want to look at any point in history and find what's wrong or right in it, you can. But at the end of the day, you cannot, you really can't assail the principles. And I'm glad you talked about the fact that some of these guys were very wealthy, some of these guys were very elitist. They understood above all else human nature. They understood all else how they got there. They didn't want to get there to be in control of it. It's a difference between an authoritarian and a person who believes in liberty and freedom and God-given rights. One person wants to lift everybody else up or give everybody else the opportunity to come up to their level. One person wants to control how they do it.
That's right.
One person wants to meet it out to them in little doses so that they will always and forever be in control. These guys understood their own human nature as well as anybody ever has or may to, you know, to the future, the way we're going. They knew to build in safeguards that prevent the world and even themselves from taking control. Did it work entirely? No, because people chipped away at it. People started using lawfare as early as, like, you know, 1780 and 1790 mm-hmm. to chip away at these principles, because they knew these principles, when they worked, prevented people from assuming authoritarian control. Mm-hmm. And so we've been doing this, this country's been doing this battle for over 200 years.
Oh, yeah.
We're starting to slide with global help, you know.
Yeah, it's a constant battle. It's a constant battle. It has to constantly be renewed. And Jefferson said that as well, you know, constantly mm-hmm. tree of liberty, constantly refreshed with the blood of patriots and tyrants.
It's Miltonesque. It's like, you're going to, if you sell your soul at some point, you're, you know, right. good luck getting back out. Once you go far enough down, the adage, what's it, what's in Churchill? If you find yourself going through hell, keep going. There's no exit sometimes. You can't just be deep. You're not coming back.
I know. I said that at the very beginning, that when we went into lockdown on that Monday following the Friday the 13th, I said, keep calm and carry on. Remember, that was the sign that was there as they had this massive army right across the channel. And also, freedom is in peril, defend it in all your might. I said, look, these guys knew they were going to die. It isn't any question if there's some disease or something like that. But they were concerned about preserving liberty and freedom, as Jefferson was. He said, look, life is not, you can't take away life and liberty. You can destroy those, but you can't separate them from each other. Right. And so that was what gave us a free society that respected freedom and dignity and all the rest of these things. I can't even imagine anybody in today's world saying the kinds of things that JFK said, for example. He said, look, a rising tide floats all boats. Can you imagine anybody thinking like that anymore? And that wasn't just him thinking, saying this on his own. That was really kind of the whole zeitgeist of our society and of our government at the time. Let's help everybody get a home. Well, that's not what they're doing anymore. They're all in it for themselves. They're all, it's a looting mentality that is happening at this point in time. And they all think that they're going to come out on top.
That's a part that I I'm glad you brought that up there, because that's a part that I saw, I even saw it back when I was in school, because my family worked very hard to move to the suburbs. Both my parents worked. My mom went back to college. By the time I was in late in elementary school and in high school, I was home alone most of the time. My brother and my sister went off to school, and I was, raised myself in a lot of ways. And, we came from a very lower middle class, sort of beginning. When I went to school, in an affluent suburb of New York, I saw as a kid the agenda sort of switch. I saw the what they were teaching us change.
Yes.
I saw myself being given choices instead of being given opportunities. I saw myself being taught by some teachers in an increasing manner through high school, especially. You were taught about the things you could, again, like I said before, the things you could pick from a list as opposed to the things you can, the list you can make, if that makes sense. And that sounds, it sounds a little weird, but oddly enough, I went to a Catholic college, and the most freedom I had to argue with my professors or my teachers, the most freedom I had to choose what I wanted to study, the most freedom I had to disagree or agree was in a Catholic school, which my entire high school taught me was not the case. Like, or you go to a Catholic school, they're going to ram religion down your throat, and you're not going to give you any, they're going to control your mind, you're going to this. And then it was an eye-opening experience for me, because I went to Iona College, and when I got to Iona College, I was arguing theology with my, because I had to take, one class in, theology. I was arguing, God and theology with my professor, and he was like, great, bring it on. This is the conversation we should be having.
Yeah,
and I'm like,
exactly.
Well, this is completely different from what happened when I was in high school. People were telling me we can't have that conversation.
Yeah.
You should know.
Yeah. If you really believe, if you've wrestled with this stuff yourself, and we all should, understand, you cared enough to look into it. Is there a God? Is this stuff true? And you've looked into that. You welcome the discussion that is there. You don't try to run from what is true. You unleash it, as Augustine said, right?
Yeah.
Truth is like a lion that you unleash. Let's have that debate. And it really is out of those kinds of religious foundations that our society said, well, the answer to bad speech is more speech, and we're going to continue to want to free things up. We don't want to have some small clique of people who are going to control everything. You had Francis Bacon who said that. We want to have a scientific method. We don't want to have experts, but now we're going in the other direction really hard, and we got to push back hard against that. That's a key thing, to reject this idea of scientific dogma that's going to be put on people. That's an intolerant religion that can't stand scrutiny.
A lot of scientists are complaining that it's become a dogma or religion. I mean, a lot more and more scientists are complaining every day that it's a dogma or religion. But we're turning everything. Is this Marxism? It smells and looks like it, because at the end of the day, making everything a division, a quantification and a division, making everything into a dogma, is literally straight out of like the Saul Alinsky, straight out of the Marxist playbook. And it's really funny too, because when I went into advertising, I studied Edward Bernays and I studied all the tools of propaganda I could use, because that was my job. But when I got into it, I had to learn the human nature behind it. And I'd taken psychology in school. I actually majored in it for a while. But when I saw it in operation, I was like, wow, this is really dangerous stuff. Mm-hmm. Like this is, and I did, at that point, I chose to use it for, you know, I'm going to teach kids. I'm not going to sell my clients' products. I'm not going to sell their toys and games. I'm going to sell why kids come to it. Like I explained people, but there's no such thing as a brand without people. You can make a logo, you can do a million, you know, television commercials, you can bombard people with the message, but unless people join and they're seeking some kind of experience or empowerment or some kind of benefit, that's where the brand lies. The brand lies in the consent of the governed, for mm-hmm. lack of a better way to put it. Mm-hmm. And so you can govern them all you want, but when you go off the rails with your brand, you know, the way some companies have in the last 2 or 3 years, let's say, the people just go, we're not having it. This is not who we are. We don't care what you are. This is not who we are. And again, that's a big component of what I wanted to take away to do from Revolution Empire. This, we have consent. We were born with consent. We were born with the ability to make the choice and make the decision that we are free to do so, that that's our call. And when governments are built, they're supposed to be built. What gives 5 people the right to rule over 500 people or 5,000 people?
That's right.
Only if those 5,000 people agree that those people can govern. And that's that's a big central premise. Well, I want a boardroom. Do I want a boardroom telling me what I can and can't buy or what I should do? Do I want a Wall Street telling me what I can and I can't buy and what I can do? No. It's like, I want the choices. I want my choices. I want my freedom.
That's right. And yes, I think typically sold to us as these people who are experts, they know better than we do. You know, it's a paternalism that is there, and that enables the socialism. That is what they come in with Marxism. Oh, we're going to, do this for the good of the group, right? Trample over the rights of the individual. And it was a very different approach that Jefferson and others took, where they said, mm-hmm. we are going to, what is government's purpose? Well, government's purpose is to protect our God-given rights and otherwise leave us alone. And so that's a fundamentally different approach than any of these other systems or any of these other historical governments had. And of course, we have gotten away from that in our paternalism. You know, when you talk about your book, that's a key thing, and I think it's important for people to see this type of understanding, this approach, this philosophy in a futuristic standpoint, because that's another thing I see people despairing of. Well, look at this sophisticated technology. We've never wedded this kind of totalitarianism with technology, and we need to understand that the human nature can overcome that technology or anything that is created to control us by other humans. We can overcome that.
Listen, 95% of the universe is invisible and can't be measured, dark matter.
That's right.
And so, and a lot of scientists are looking at intelligent design now, cosmologists, because they're going like, well, wow, we can't figure out how this universe came to be. We don't know where it came from. Mm-hmm. We know that it started. That's all we know. But the complexity of it and the sheer, the sheer mind-numbing complexity of that in DNA seems to have an imprint of a design, a predetermined design. But we're only as good. The takeaway is we're only as good as the tools we have to measure, right? And so, in terms of science is limited by our powers of observation and then our materials that we use to measure. I'm going to shift this over to what you were just talking about. When you talk about totalitarianism and you talk about new technology, you talk about new things that we can use, which may or may not damage our rights. What are we measuring those with? And so the greatest tools we have created on Earth to this point, in terms of government, in terms of rights, is the Constitution and the Bill of Rights, because those are the one group of documents and group of thoughts that restored power from the few to everyone. They gave power to everyone. The idea of these documents was to give power to everyone equally, in a sense. You had your power. Those are now measurement tools. They're almost like scientific tools. If you look at AI, we should be measuring that against rights. We should be measuring that against our rights as sentient beings, our rights to determination. At some point, giving away any of that is a danger. Giving away any of our choice is a danger. These things, like everything else, are tools. Like I'm using AI right now in various things. I do a lot of consulting work too, and I'm using the AI in the consulting work. I keep it in a box because that's where it should be. It in a box over here. I use it for what it is, but I use it so I can evaluate it. Because the dream is, you look at what's the guy named Noah Harari? Is that the guy's name?
Yuval Harari. Yeah.
Yuval Harari. Right.
Yeah.
Oh, the machines should just make.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
What a wacky thing to say. The machine should make all the decisions for us. Mm-hmm. You know, I remember back in the day, I didn't believe it. A friend of mine sent me a thing that said that the slogan of the World Economic Forum was, you'll own nothing and be happy. And I didn't believe it. And I looked it up on the site, and there it was. And I took a screenshot of it because I couldn't believe that I saw it. And it's been taken down like long ago, 2 years ago or so, it was taken down. Mm-hmm. And the UN had a site up that said the same thing. And I had screenshots of it. It was taken down. I couldn't believe that it was there. And I'm going like, if that's the vision that we're going towards, then this book needs to come out.
Oh, yeah.
And that's kind of.
And we can see how that is rolling out. We can see how that's rolling out as well, because, you know, we look at this foundation of individual liberty, how it was used to create prosperity. And you look at the middle of the 20th century, where we started having the ability to have a home, and you know, that necessitated people being able to commute, the suburbs that they hate and all the rest of the stuff. But now even the appliances, you know, not just the cars, but now they're even coming for the appliances, coming up for ways to take everything away from us. And so we see this, it's like a bell-shaped curve. We got up to the top, and now we're on the way down, where they're stripping all this stuff away from us that were essentially accoutrements of the liberty and freedom, so that they can get down to that foundation of liberty, freedom, and take that away from us and completely enslave us. That's what it's all really about with what they're doing. It's a pretty clear agenda, I think.
For sure. And David, flashing back to the revolution, to the post-revolution, you know, let's flash back to the early 1800s. Some of these things were stripped away. We're being stripped away then, mm-hmm. by decisions that were being made by people. But the thing that people forget, when you can look back at the country, and if you want to be a person who poo-poos the U.S. and says, look at all the bad things they did, and blah, 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 you can pick these things out as individual little moments and say, well, freedom was taken away here, and this was then there. But these were always done by people who had authoritarian or controlling agendas and wanted things to be controlled or parsed out in a certain way, and they damaged our rights. They switched things in the Constitution. They switched things a little bit. Again, they changed laws. They maneuvered around things. Mm-hmm. So the fundamental rights and principles always applied from the beginning, still apply. The only way authoritarians can get a hold of this country is to bastardize them. And run around them, because they can't be fought directly.
Yeah, that's right. Let me ask you, because there's so many parallels in your book to 1776. You understand that. You're teaching that in this in an interesting way. As we mentioned before, you know, we talk about God-given rights. And, mm-hmm. of course, their faith in God was a key aspect of that. Does that play a role in your book as well?
Absolutely.
Good.
Absolutely.
Good.
Yep.
Good. Well, that's a key thing. Yeah.
It's too big of a part of human history, and it's an important part of human history. You know, again, behaviorists, psychologists, and scientists, again, admit for the most part that human beings, for whatever reason, I don't know what it could be, are wired to believe in a higher power. We are literally genetically, evolutionarily wired to believe in God and predisposed to believe in God. Well, why do we have that? You know, why would we why what's the evolutionary purpose of that? From a purely scientific mm-hmm. perspective, like if I was Elon Musk, well, what's the purpose of, why would we have that? So we have it for We've evolved it for some reason. What did it serve? Well, you know, it's funny. I just did some consulting work on this, and you know, it turns out statistically, people are healthier. They live longer. They live better together. They live better with each other if they are believers in God. Mm-hmm. They're believers in the divine. They're actually better people. Mm-hmm. Not better people. That's a bad thing. Bad way to say it. But
well, they have a better life. We'll just put it that way.
They end up with a better life, and they end up better to each other, and they end up doing better things in the world. And so, I don't understand why I didn't understand why churches were shut down during the pandemic, and you know, bars and strip clubs were open. I couldn't process why
that was a big tell.
why we're assailing all religion and all faith meanwhile, as some global governments, they are fighting against nations and people who are fiercely religious and God believing. Yes. And so at some point you're what's going on? So I had to put that in the book because it's a huge component of life that again is under attack. Religious liberty is under attack the same way personal liberty is.
Can't leave that out of the story of America. You really
can't leave that out of the story of America.
The idea of freedom and individual liberty either. Well, the book is called Revolution Empire, and it is book one, History Never Retreats. And it's going to be a series, and it looks like a wonderful book. And we've got a writer here, Rob, who says Gard Goldsmith is a listener. He's got shows of his own, Liberty Conspiracy and stuff. He said, I can't wait to get those novels. And I think it's going to be a very popular series, and it truly is has been interesting talking to you. I can't wait to see it myself either. So thank you so much for joining us, and good luck with this. And I hope it gets a wide audience. We'll do what we can to push this out there. Thank you very much.
I appreciate that. Have people look it up on Amazon by name, because Amazon has a weird sort of thing where they new books sometimes they bury, they're a little harder to find. So if you look up Revolution Empire, you might see 12 other books with it. If you look up Revolution Empire with my name,
Rob Travalino, Travalino, Rob Travalino. Look that up on Amazon to find it. That's great. And it's coming out in the middle of July, right? The first book.
It was out July 25th.
Okay, great, great. Look forward to seeing that. Thank you so much, Rob. I appreciate it. The Common Man. They created Common Core to dumb down our children. They created Common Pass to track and control us. Their Commons Project to make sure the commoners own nothing. And the communist future. They see the common man as simple, unsophisticated, ordinary. But each of us has worth and dignity created in the image of God. That is what we have in common. That is what they want to take away. Their most powerful weapons are isolation, deception, intimidation. They desire to know everything about us while they hide everything from us. It's time to turn that around and expose what they want to hide. Please share the information and links you'll find at thedavidknightshow.com. Thank you for listening. Thank you for sharing. If you can't support us financially, please keep us in your prayers. thedavidknightshow.com.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you wanna get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.